Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Kadampa Center. We are really happy tonight to be welcoming back to our center after an absence of a couple of years, Venerable Robina Curtin on her international Rolling Thunder tour. She's going to be here all week, all the way through this coming Sunday. She'll be teaching every evening on a different topic throughout the week. And then over the weekend, Friday night, Saturday, all day, and Sunday afternoon, she'll be teaching a weekend workshop on the path of the Lam Rim. I don't remember what exciting topic name we gave it, but she'll be teaching all weekend on that topic. And if you're in the Discovering Buddhism class, this coordinates with the module that you're on right now, so you can also attend that. Tonight she's going to be teaching on Mahamudra, and we do have copies of this book in the bookstore if you are inspired by what she has to say. And of course you'll be inspired by what she has to say, because she's pretty amazing. If you haven't seen her before, fasten your seatbelts. Couple of just logistical and protocol notes. If you're a regular at Kadampa Center, then you're accustomed to Geshe Gelug's wishes. It's traditional, actually, when the teacher enters the room. Of course, we will stand, and we're going to do that with Venerable Robina. And then Geshe-la requests that we prostrate with him when he prostrates, and this is an expression of his humility. But it is traditional that we wait until the teacher is seated, and then we prostrate. If prostration is new to you and you don't know what this is and you feel very uncomfortable with it, or even a little tiny bit uncomfortable with it, you're welcome to just stand and wait until others prostrate. At Kadampa Center, we have a long tradition of offering the teachings at no charge, so that everybody can hear these precious words. But we do, of course, have expenses to bring a teacher in. So if you feel moved at any time during this week to either donate or sponsor the teachings, you can go to our website. You can go to the bookstore. There's a credit card machine there. There's a little box on the wall right outside the Gampa, and your donations are very welcome, and they're also a great benefit to you because they benefit others by making it possible for them to hear the teachings. Tonight when she sits down, we're going to be doing a mandala, or requesting mandala offering. This is like a symbolic offering to the teacher of everything in the universe, the best of the best. So you'll see a few of us come up, and so you'll understand what's going on. The first few times I saw that, I thought, oh, that's really pretty. I wonder what all that means. And that's what it is. It's again, we're asking the teacher in her kindness to give us the teachings. And so this is just one of the things that we do. So she should be here any moment now, and we're really happy to have her here and happy to have all of you here to hear her. If you have any questions, you can always come and find me. I'm Donna. I'm the Spiritual Program Coordinator. We also have our visiting teachers team. Can the three of you stand up? So Linda and Laura and Susie did a lot of the planning, and Susan Daniel is our program assistant tonight, so we've got scads of people ready to help you, and Jill is also there who can help you. So thank you, and we'll just wait.
Turn to page 97 in the prayer book.
Very tiny.
Okay, what we're doing here is they're offering, it's a bit esoteric, they're offering a thing which represents the universe, you'd never know. And it's like an offering to the Buddha as a request for the teachings. And then the next thing we're going to offer is representations of enlightened body, speech, and mind as like a cause for us to achieve these. That's what they're offering. So you should do that one. Go on. Then I've got to find a way how I can see everybody. So I can't see all you back there. What to do? Go on. You want to sing the prayer?
Page 97. Sāji pūkhi jūshin mētā trāmrī-rābhīngji nīdē
Beginning, get people to help you.
Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kam Niryat.
Okay. Okay, I'm not so sure here. What happens? Just a minute. Do it for me.
Here we go.
Okay, there we go. That's no good. Can't be like this. Sorry. Okay. Well, I think it's 3 years since I've been here. It feels like about 50 since I've been here. I used to come every year, so 3 years is a long time. So let's make the most of it, okay? Just now, Donna's going to get a platform, so they can put it under the chair, so I can be higher, so I can see you. But she was nervous because I nearly fell off last time. But I'd rather see you. I mean, even if I have to stand up, I'd rather do that, because I can't see most of you at the back. Should be like at the baseball, where you sort of, it goes up at the back, you know. So this is the topic, is it? Is this what I was supposed to talk about? Is that the plan? Is that it? Does anybody know? Okay, good. Well, I should sing a little prayer as well, but never mind. I was thinking we're going to do this teaching so we can think about the meaning of these things, so we can develop our amazing potential, so we can be a benefit to others. Thinking like that. You know, discover our true nature. I mean, that's kind of intense words, isn't it? You know, what do they mean? Well, you know, it's really, in one way, it's so easy, it's so simple, it's embarrassing when we hear the words, but don't hold your breath for achieving it. It's like a long-term job. But the word Buddha itself is telling us exactly what our nature is. And this is pretty abstract for us, because it's not how we think in our neuroscience, it's not how we think in our modern psychology, which of course is why we think it's religion, so we stick it in the sky. But not for the Buddha. This is real, in-the-mind stuff everybody can accomplish, you know. So our true nature then, if we look at this word Buddha, or we look at the Sanskrit, the Tibetan equivalent, Sangye. Sang implies the total eradication from our mind, from our being, of all ego, all fears, all anger, all depression, all anxiety, all jealousy, all the things that we are truly, totally familiar with. Anxiety, low self-esteem, worry, resentment, jealousy, depression. We know these words so intimately. Look, see, look, it's coming. Okay, I'll keep talking and then let them do their job, okay? Then I'll go back on the chair. Okay, so the first syllable, like I said, implies, and hear these words, they're incredibly simple, but it seems like quite shocking. We can get rid that anger, ego, fears, jealousy, the stuff that we really are preoccupied with, that we really do feel we are know intimately, and which we cannot stand. We know this so well. This stuff, the Buddha has found, this person 2,500 years ago in India, he has found from his own experience, this is not a belief thing, this is his own experience, that this stuff is not at the core of our being. This stuff can be removed. That's the long-term result. That's just one part. That's the first syllable, bud, sang. Ge, buddha, sang ge, the second syllable, implies that not only can we rid the mind of all the rubbish, We can grow to perfection all the other stuff in our mind that we are also totally familiar with. Love, compassion, kindness, generosity, forgiveness, patience. I mean, we know these words. They're so familiar to us. They're so ordinary, you know? I mean, we use fancy, complicated words in psychology and psychiatry. These are down-to-earth words, how we all talk. This is the stuff of Buddhist psychology. This is the stuff of Buddhist practice. And you could say all the things we do, you know, all these complicated things like this thing I just did then, all these weird pictures and prayers and me having a bald head and wearing these strange clothing and doing all these prostrations and saying all these Sanskrit words, all these things that seem so esoteric, the only purpose for any of those is to help us do this actual job, as Lama Yeshe puts it, as being your own therapist. So you can do what? So you can discover your true nature. That's the way Buddhism's talking. So it's a bit of a shocking concept. If one of you is a therapist, and I come and ask you, there you go, that's a bit better. I won't fall off, I promise.
Will that be okay?
But I don't need the thing, just give me a cushion. Thank you. I'll see if it's any better. Can I see you? I bet it's going to be the same. I still can't see you. Why don't I sit on that? No? That won't sit on there.
Do you want an extra cushion?
One more cushion, yeah. Yeah, one more cushion.
Brian, go, is that a time?
I'm sure this is the same problem every year, isn't it?
Yeah.
No? But I'm always wanting to go up higher. Not because I'm a special person, but I want to see you all. So now I've got to put this for my feet now.
Okay.
Give this for my feet. Give me
your toes.
A little bit better. I can sort of see you all. If you can, like they say on the truck, if you can see me, I can see you, you know? Okay, all right.
Want to build up with the Sabitron?
Give me the big ones better. The big ones better. Here, hold it. The big ones are better.
Yeah, it's not too well.
The big one, this one. Better, like that. That's it. And I'll sit on that with one more cushion. Yeah, that's it. Oh, no. No, the other ones now. Now the other ones. One of those. That's it.
That.
No, that's fine. I'm happy. This is it. Perfect.
Okay.
Good. Thank you. Then give me the feet. Okay, now I'm happy. Now I can see you. Okay. Thank you so much. I'm sorry. All right. So did you hear what I said so far?
Yes.
Good. This is the essence of it. But, you know, like I said, if one of you is a therapist, and think about this, it's quite serious. If one of you is a therapist, and I come to you and I say, would you please give me methods to get rid of all ego, all fears, all anger, all jealousy, all depression, all anxiety, forever. I don't mean immediately, it'll take time, but forever. You would laugh because we have no concept like that in our psychology. We just don't think this way. That's why when we hear these words, we go, oh yeah, that's religion, it's in the sky, yeah, yeah, wow, wow, when you die, it'll achieve it. You know, not like that. Not like that for Buddhism. Not like that. This is what Buddha has found is the natural potential of every single being. So where does that stuff exist? What part of us does love, hate, anger, jealousy, depression, kindness exist? Well, broadly speaking, we call it our mind, don't we? So, you know, of course, Buddha's views about the mind are quite radically different. But even if we didn't know where our mind was, even if we're not sure whether it's in our toenail or our crown, you don't need to know that stuff. We know those feelings. We know those emotions. We're familiar with them. So the whole job of being a Buddhist, putting it in very simple terms, is these techniques that help us learn to become familiar, to get in touch with the underpinning, the conceptual stories underpinning these emotions. Because when we say these words, we mean emotions. When we say love, we mean emotion. When we say attachment, we mean emotion. But we've got to go beyond those emotions. And that's why this simple, practical, psychological skill that the world vaguely knows as mindfulness meditation, and that wasn't just coming from the Buddha, that's coming from these genius Indians well before that. I remember the Dalai Lama saying, and I quote this a lot these days, it was these amazing Indians more than 3,000 years ago who were the ones who first began the investigation into the nature of self. So, of course, we in, you know, our Judeo-Christian world know nothing about India. We love to go back to the Greeks. You think about it, all our fancy words are in Greek, aren't they, you know? What do we know about India? Nothing at all. So it's kind of powerful to hear this. And this is there's an extraordinary system that Buddha got born into, these amazing thinkers and scholars and meditators and yogis, extraordinary sophisticated beings, you know, with this remarkable set of ethics who really understood the human mind intimately. And that is the skill that Buddha got from there. Then he diverged in his own direction, which is how come we have Buddhism now. So there's a very long history to these views that we're describing here, you know. And they're unknown to us in our culture. These days now, the last 50, 60 years since the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans have come from Tibet into India and then coming to the West, it's only now that we're hearing these things and having them published in our language, you know. They're very fascinating. It's actually extraordinary. I think Western modern science will be fascinated to study these models of the mind that have been around for thousands of years. But the interesting point about that is they're not describing the brain. It's the cognitive process itself, our thoughts and feelings and emotions themselves. And that's the skill we have to learn to become. That's what we have to learn to do, to become familiar, intimately, internally familiar with our thoughts and feelings and emotions in a very coherent, structured, disciplined way. And maybe that's not how we think in our culture, you know. I think for us, we think a lot about the things that caused our feelings. We'll talk about our lousy husband or our unkind sister or the mean child or the bad boss. I mean, and that's okay because they're true things. People do harm us. We talk a lot about those things in order to try and understand why we feel what we feel. But in a way, Buddha's view is very, quite shocking. It's very direct. He says, no, we don't need to do that. We need to get in touch with the anger thoughts, the conceptual stories called anger, jealousy. Because if we go beneath the emotions, we can get in touch with these deeper levels of ourselves. And this is not cosmic. This is not fantasy, I tell you. This is real stuff. But it demands a lot of courage. Because if we think about our problems, you know, why are you angry, Rabina? Well, the first thing I'll say is because Andre cheated on me. We'll say it immediately. We know that. We know very, and even if we describe, you know, if you're talking about your anger, tell me about your anger, Rabina. Tell me about your anger, Rabina. I will describe Andre. No, Rabina, tell me about your anger. You just described Andre. And I say, but I did. But we don't. We describe the object. Tell me about your happiness, Rabina. And I'll proceed to tell you about the delicious meal I had. We talk about the external objects, and we know that. And they play a very powerful role, but for us, we put all the power into knowing about the external objects. But the Buddha's emphasis is learning to know what is triggered by contact with the objects, whether the thoughts and feelings are positive or whether they're neurotic and miserable. We have to learn to become familiar with what goes on in our mind. That's the real skill that the Buddha, you could say, that the Buddha has. And you don't have to believe, this is not a question of believing. This level of Buddhism, you don't even need to think, like I said, you don't need to care whether your brain, like I said, whether you think your brain is in your skull or your toenail. I don't care. We know we can become familiar with our thoughts. We know that. We can do that, and that's the job we have to learn to do. So why would we want to become familiar with our thoughts? Because the Buddha's point is we can change them. Okay, the end result, get rid of all the rubbish altogether, that's a bit radical. Even if you can't imagine being completely rid of all anger or jealousy, even if you can't conceive of that possibility, it implies that you can change. And that's the skill. That's the job we have to learn. And what we're trying to change is not the brain. We're not discussing that. That's a whole business. Neuroscience is fine. We're discussing changing the concept, all the conceptual stories that go on in our mind that are in fact, that what inform our emotions. So there are many stumbling blocks in doing this, you know. The first one is because from the second we wake up in the morning, you think about it, until the second we go to sleep, where is all our attention going? It's obvious, the outside world. That's the point. We focus, all our attention is focused out there. So that's what we're paying attention to. You know, and that's why we blame, if you like, we blame the outside. We also blame the outside for our happiness. Why are you happy, Rabina? Well, Andre was kind to me. It's the same logic, you know. We're so emphasizing the external. And don't get all holy about that. I mean, you're allowed to have delicious chocolate cakes and handsome boyfriends. That's not the issue. It's that we're not paying attention enough to what goes on in here. That's the point. So from the second we wake up in the morning until the second we go to sleep, all our attention is focused out there. So, of course, we're describing what's out there. And when we meet the things that we find delicious, we think it's the cause of our happy feelings. And we meet the things that we think are ugly and they're the cause of our unhappy feelings. That's, of course, what we think every day. So then, of course, we avoid that cake or avoid that boyfriend because that's what we think. But the Buddhist one is we have to learn to pay attention to what's being triggered in here. So the second obstacle, which is really coming from the first, is that, you know, we pay our attention to the outside, but we really do believe they are the main cause of my happy feelings, and we really do believe they are the main cause of our suffering feelings. But the Buddha's point is, yes, of course they play a role. And yes, of course, if Andre cheats on you, not appropriate. And yes, it's marvelous if someone is kind to you. He's not arguing with that. He just says we give all the power to that. But his point eventually is the main player in our happiness and suffering, the main player is our own thoughts and feelings themselves, which is a bit shocking because that's not what we tend to think. So that the other major problem, a stumbling block in learning to become intimately familiar with our thoughts and feelings and emotions in a very coherent way so that we can do the job of reconfiguring our thoughts, really reinterpreting the way the world is, because that's what it means by changing your mind. The other stumbling block is we only notice really what's happening inside our mind, inside us, when it's too late. In other words, you're so mad at somebody, what'll I do about my anger? Well, it's a bit late to wait until you're really mad at somebody. You know, we wait till it's too late. That's our problem. We're going to have something falling over here. Look. I'm sorry. Let's just give me a cushion. That's better.
Give me something for your back.
Just take that off and give me a cushion. No, I can't do that. It's no good. Yeah, take it away. Give us a cushion. A cushion. Whoops-a-daisy. I'm sorry, causing problems again. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. That's auspicious. Don't worry. It's a good sign. Don't worry about it. It's called purification. I'm okay. Now I'm fine. It's just the flowers. It's okay. Oh, lovely flowers. Look at that. Come on. It's okay. Some people down there need a seat. Have they got a seat down there? It's okay. It's fine. Let it be. It's good. It's only water. Okay, I'll wait while we get distracted. Beautiful flowers, thank you. Okay. So this is the main problem. Let's try and look at this problem. Let's look at this problem. This is the main one. I'll give an analogy. It sounds funny, but try and hear the point. You'll hear it. It's like we are with our thoughts and feelings, noticing them. It's like you've never heard of mechanics. You've never heard that you should check your car, check the wheels, check the brakes, check the, you know, all the different things, put the oil in, put the water in, whatever you do these days with their electronic cars, but check them to make sure they're behaving well before you hop onto the freeway. We kind of understand that. But it's a bit like the way we are with noticing our problems, noticing our emotions, you know, it's like you've never heard of mechanics, and it's only when you're going 100 miles an hour on the freeway and suddenly you notice your wheels are falling off and you say, uh-oh, what'll I do? Well, it's sort of obvious that it's a bit late. The best you can do is damage control, but really I think it is like that. This is a major point. It is like that with us. We only notice when our emotions are so strong, which means when our body is involved. Then when the anger is pouring out the mouth, when you can't get out of bed one morning because you're inert with depression. It's only when you notice what your body is feeling that we realize we're having problems. But why? Because we don't pay attention to our thoughts. We don't pay attention to what goes on in here because we're so focused on what's going on out there. So we know from the second we wake up in the morning until the second we go to sleep, we know there are thoughts non-stop, like this river of thoughts underneath, isn't it? We know that. Constantly. You know what it's like when you can't get to sleep one night. You think you're going completely crazy. The thought's going completely crazy. We know this. Well, these thoughts are there all the time. But because we're so busy in daily life, we just don't pay attention. But it's only when we've got so much emotion, when you're so angry or so hurt or so pained or so depressed, then you notice, but that's the wheels falling off and that's just too late. But that's what our society is. I mean, to think, you know, for example, one of the ideas about meditation, many misconceptions about meditation is, you know, it's an alternative to a pill. You do it when you've got a problem. So if I'm in love with Andre and we're having a wonderful relationship and there's no trouble yet, there's no dramas yet, and someone says, well, you know, you should learn to meditate, Rabina, I would laugh and say, why should I? I don't have a problem. We really think of meditation like that. That's completely misconception. That's, again, waiting. Why would, you know, so you don't wait till your teeth fall out before you go to the dentist. You don't wait till the wheels fall off. But we really do that when it comes to emotions. We don't have any methods. We wait till it's too late. And no one, and look at the seriousness of that. I mean, it's not a joke, you know. I always quote this. It's like a number that's accepted on the planet, that 40% of all women who get murdered by the bloke in the same bed. This is not against men. This is talking about we're not noticing problems until it's too late. We don't notice until we're so depressed. We just don't pay attention. That's the trouble. And this is a major point. You know, even if we could take the simplest advice from Buddhism, you can be a 1% Buddhist, I promise. You don't have to do all the religious stuff. I really mean it. If you could really take the practical advice that the Buddhist approach has, which is that you have some little kind of a focusing practice in the morning with a genuine, you know, a genuine wish just to pay attention, to train your mind to pay attention for 5 minutes, like to your breath or something. It's a training, not magical technique that'll bring some kind of special feelings. It's training. What you're doing is training yourself for a few minutes every day to get out of your head, to focus on your breath, not just to be mindlessly doing what you're doing every day. Then you bring to bear in your daily life that focus that you bring, then you'll naturally start to also notice not just what's going on in the traffic, not just what the boyfriend is doing, not just what the kids are doing, which is where usually our focus is, but you're also noticing what on earth is going on inside your head. You're hearing all the crazy thoughts. In the beginning, they even say it in the text, when you start to meditate, one of the signs of success is that you think you're getting worse. You're not. You're just noticing the thoughts that are there all the time. But that's the real job. We're not getting worse, but we have to pay attention. And then slowly, slowly, we learn the skill to listen to the crazy stories and the thoughts and the anger building up before it vomits out the mouth and you do the damage. This is so practical, I can't tell you. It's so practical. This is what we have to learn to do. In other words, before you get the wheels fall off, you notice the wheels are wobbling. So you get them fixed before they fall off. It's obvious. The same here. You notice the wobbles in your mind. You notice you're getting annoyed. You notice you're getting upset about this. You're noticing it inside you before it comes out the mouth, before you can't get out of bed one morning. This is so practical, I can't tell you. And it's nothing to do with religion. It's common sense. It's practical common sense, I promise. This is the heart job that Buddhism would talk about doing. We get so caught up in all this holy stuff. You know, look at this place, you know. I mean, nothing wrong with it. I'm not criticizing. I mean, it's not a criticism. I don't mean it like that. But look at it. I mean, they beat the Catholics. Look at this, you know. I was a Catholic. Isn't it? All these pictures and medieval and 9th century and... I mean, look at me, how I'm dressed, you know. This is 2,500-year-old habit. Except when I was with a Mexican, when I was in Los Angeles, I met this little boy with a bald head. And I said, I've got a bald head because I'm a Buddhist nun. I said, why have you got a bald head? I've got a bald head because I'm a gangster, he said. So are we communicating here? So our true nature is our true nature from the Buddhist perspective is the goodness in us. I mean, it sounds so cute to talk like this, you know. Compassion and kindness. But don't think because it sounds easy to say it that it's easy to do it. It's the hardest job we'll ever do. It is really the hardest job we'll ever do because we are addicted to the outside. We're addicted to thinking the suffering's out there, the happiness is out there. That's a very ancient habit in us, very deep, deeply ingrained habit. And of course, Buddha would say we bring it with us from past lives. That's how long the habit is. But to even forget that, you know. But if we can start to pay attention to what's happening in our mind before it gets to the mouth. I mean, this is already, we know what I'm saying. I mean, speech, we might not go around punching too many people or killing too many people, but we know our speech. Especially at work, with family. The speech is where we do so much damage. And we know once it's out the mouth, you can't bring it back. You know, we know that. Because that we can't control our emotions. It's really clear. We can't control our emotions. Why? Because we don't pay attention to them. It's not rocket science, you know. Then we feel all guilty and bad. Then we have to go to a therapist and get pills and things, you know. Do you understand? So this is an ongoing, it's a full-on job. Because in a way, because the habit is so deep to blame the cake for why you're happy and to blame the boyfriend for why you're suffering, that's a very deep habit. But if we can catch and become familiar with our thoughts, the stories in there and our old habits and try to reconfigure them, that's the real job and that's what takes time. It's a really hard job, but it's doable. That's the point. It's doable. See, that's why for me it was always so powerful working with people in prison. I mean, people in this room. Andre, you still go to prison? We help the boys there? That's wonderful. You know, because Buddha's got a saying, and it's infuriating. If you can change something, hey, baby, please change it. But what if you can't? And if we look at our lives, we know so many times that thing in front of us, just the red lights of the traffic. If you have some magic pill, magic button to press and make it green, please, baby, go for it. But what if you haven't? We know so many of the things in our daily life we can't change. We know that, but we bash our heads against brick walls. And this is where, I mean, simple examples. Forget about the major, serious problems. If you can change it, no problem. If Andre's mean to me and I can say, please, darling, will you stop being mean? And he stops being mean, then I've just succeeded, haven't I? But what if he doesn't? This is always the point. This is always the point. And this is the point. If we get what we want, then we're fine. But what if we don't? Another way of putting it. Another way of putting this, if we look at all the unhappy states of mind, Buddha psychology is hilarious. He's articulated 84,000 distinct problems in the mind. 84,000. But he luckily narrows it down to 3. And they call them the 3 poisons. It's so cute, you know. But I think we can be more modern and call them the 3 toxic emotions. That's a delicious phrase, isn't it? The toxic emotions. That's a really good phrase. Buddha would really have liked that. The 3 toxic emotions. But when we hear them, they sound so cute to us, you know. But when we start to really unpack these, it's mind-blowing how deep they go, you know. So effectively the 3, and there's a very distinct relationship between these 3, like a hierarchical relationship. The root of them, the root of these neurotic states of mind, you know, is called ego grasping. It's like a very colloquial term, and it's this very deeply instinctive, deeply ingrained, kind of panic-stricken, fear-based, wrong, ridiculous sense of self. It's very deep inside. But forget that one. On the basis of that one, which drives everything, the 2 main ones effectively in our daily life that are the source of all our problems, and this sounds so cute, but I'm going to unpack it. We'll unpack it and you'll see what I'm saying, are called attachment and aversion. Attachment and aversion. Well, you listen. You'll recognize, I promise. Attachment is the main one. It's the main voice of this poor unhappy self. The main voice of this poor unhappy ego grasping, known colloquially. And so basically it's multifaceted, you know. And we're born with this, Buddha would say. And it's common to all beings. Join the universe here. The most primordial level of it is this deepest instinctive feeling that I don't have enough. I am not enough. No matter what I get, not enough. No matter what I achieve, not enough. No matter what I do, not enough. No matter how much Andre tells me he loves me, never enough. It's a bottomless pit of this never enough. Well, we know this one. It's like, what do we call it? The glass half full or something. We can see that. Forget yourself, but look at some people who just always unhappy, and don't criticize, it's heartbreaking, always dissatisfied, no matter what happens. This is the deepest, most primordial kind of energetic level of this cute word attachment, you know, the way Buddha describes it. The next level of it is, because you always feel there's never enough and you haven't got enough, obviously the next level is you start hankering after something. And where do you look? Out there, obviously. Where else? Because it's this feeling of attachment. It also makes us feel very lonely and separate. So there's poor, lonely, nothing me with nothing and never enough. And there's all delicious world out there, isn't it? That's how we think of the life. So there's this next level of attachment is this hankering. There must be something out there such that when I get it, it'll fill up the gaping hole. This is ordinary daily life. We completely attach to the objects of the senses. And this is not something articulate. You don't sort of say these words to yourself. We are programmed with this stuff, Buddha says. It's so deeply ingrained. And this is the stuff we have to learn to become familiar with. And it takes time, you know, because it's also automatic. It's programmed in us. From Buddha would say, from much practice. So the next level of this attachment, this energy, is the naturally hankering after something. When you think about that object, the person, the cake, whatever, you know, you think about it all the time. You think about it, and then you exaggerate its deliciousness, and you exaggerate its role in making you happy. So all this is happening automatically. It's so primordial. It's so subtle. It's so natural. For us, we just go, yeah, that's normal. That's normal behavior. Well, it is normal, Buddha says. But he says it's so much suffering. We just have to look into it and see it and go a bit deeper. So then once we get the object, the next level is the possessiveness of it, as if it's mine, you know? Especially when it comes to people and things. But this is the energy of attachment. So one kind of brutal way of describing it is it's this primordial kind of emotional hunger that can only bear the nice things. It only wants the nice things. It can't handle anything but the nice things. And what does that mean? Another way of putting it, it can only handle what I want. So obviously what I want is what I think is nice, not what you think is nice. So this is the energy of attachment. So to summarize it, it's this constant hunger, this emotional hunger coming from feeling we haven't got enough and then projecting that onto the things and people and sounds and smells and tastes and the rest, and then and then believing when I get it, it'll fill up the gaping hole. So that's kind of, we understand this, we see it, we get it. It's got emotional hunger. An aspect of it is control freak. It's a great term we use. An aspect of it in relationships is codependence. There's many ways it functions as attachment, you know. So the point is, this is constant. It's like the motor that drives us. So as long as it gets what it wants, the cake, the green lights, Andre saying the right words, my friend saying the right things, everything going nicely, then we call that happiness. But we know it's quite fragile. We know it doesn't happen every time. We know the next day you go for the chocolate cake, it's not so nice today because it's a bit stale. Or you suddenly go at the right time for work, but suddenly the traffic backs up. You can never guarantee it. So it's really kind of stressful, isn't it? Anxiety is this, because we not. So then when we don't get what we want, when attachment doesn't get what it wants, that's the beginning of this next state of mind called aversion. Well, it sounds so strange to say aversion. So, but it too is multifaceted. So the really volatile, obvious level of aversion, which, let's face it, is simply the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants, that's called anger. Shout and yell. You know, that's the most volatile level of it. Having a panic attack when you don't get what you want. And it sounds very kind of cruel to say that. But look at the world, you know. The milder versions of anger are irritation, annoyed, frustrated, upset, anxious, worried, stressed. These are all variations of attachment not getting what it wants. When life gets too busy, the traffic gets too difficult, the kids shout too loud, and we just can't cope. That's attachment having a panic attack, and then aversion arises. We call it anxiety. We call it stressed. We call it frustrated, irritated, annoyed. Everybody knows those words. And, of course, these are the wobbles. This is when the wheels are wobbling. This is not the wheels falling off yet. That's why we don't pay attention. Oh, this is normal life, we say. And then when you want to kill Andre, now you go, well, I better do something about it. What should I do? Well, it's a bit late. I mean, I know you know what I'm saying. Are we communicating? This is simple, ordinary human stuff. This is Buddhist psychology. I mean, he doesn't talk with an Australian accent, I agree. Or Australian colloquialisms. But this is Buddhist psychology put in down-to-earth language we can all understand, you know. We recognize this. This is so natural. And because it's so, this is a tragedy, because it's so natural, we just assume it's part of life and you just kind of put up with it, you know. But the Buddha says, no, we should be brokenhearted with compassion for ourselves. This is called suffering. Didn't we realize it? When we talk about suffering, The Buddha has a very distinct way of talking about suffering. We talk, you know, we think of suffering as when you're poor or sick. But this is suffering. But we think, oh no, I'm not suffering. I've got a house. I'm not suffering. I've got food. Excuse me, there's a subtle level of suffering. It's a suffering of the mind. Look at ordinary people. We're tormented by misery and distress and worried and fearful and anxious. And we don't want to admit we've got all that stuff because we think we're crazy. And we don't know what to do with it because it's not part of our culture. We just think, I wish it would all go away, you know. We've got to deal with it. Work with it. Not be afraid of it. This is part of the problem. Not be afraid of it. It's just our mind, you know, out of control. We can learn. I mean, it takes time. Don't hold your breath. But once we know that this stuff, and this is the Buddha's point, and the more we can read these things and think about this and just sort of get inspiration from it, that this is not our true nature. It's there, it's real, we've got it, we've had it, and it's common. But it's not intrinsic to us. That's the key Buddhist point. It mightn't be evident to us, that idea. It's a brand new idea to us. I mean, in our modern society, in our modern psychology and our neuroscience, we give equal status to anger, depression, jealousy, love, compassion, kindness, as if somehow an ordinary person has a balance of all of these. That's our view, and every one of us instinctively feels that. So it sounds a bit shocking to say what Buddha's saying. You mean get rid of all that stuff? And I'm used to thinking it now because I'm a Buddhist. But I remember recently in saying these exact words, and one woman, and it was very correct the way she said it, but she said, that's bizarre. How could you be a person with no anger, no attachment, no fears? That's ridiculous. What kind of person would you be? And that makes sense because we can't conceptualize it. We can't imagine. It sounds like kind of science fiction. But this is the Buddha's point. He's been saying this for 2,500 years. Very quietly. It's all there. The system has been there, solid, in place for 2,500 years. You've got to think that. You've got to admit it's fascinating. It's not some brand new idea made up by the hippies or something, you know. This stuff's been there. This philosophy, this method, and people over the centuries accomplishing these goals. It's very fascinating. It's only now, the last 50 years in Australia and America, we're hearing about it, you know. It's very fascinating to me, that. So, okay, where to go from there? You're going to have to ask me questions now. It's 7:52, okay? Talk to me. Questions. So I've said so much already, so come on, ask me some questions. This is the essence of it all. This is the essence of it. Go on. Yeah.
Would it be a stretch to say that the Buddha taught himself to stop thinking?
That would not be right to say that. No, he didn't do that. But I can expand on that. Okay. This technique that was invented by the Indians well before the Buddha. The world knows it roughly as mindfulness meditation. And I think there's many variations of that now, and they've kind of got all sorts of bells and whistles and things. And that's okay, because Buddha doesn't own this stuff. He's not a creator. People can call it what they like. But if you want the authentic Buddhist technique, what it's actually called is concentration meditation. And the Hindus, well before him, created this. These amazing, great, sophisticated thinkers and yogis, the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self, as the Dalai Lama put it, you know, developed this technique. It's a psychological skill that enables you to, it could take you years to achieve it in a particular environment, you know, like up in the, and in order to even get to achieve it, you'd probably have to give up your husband, children, mortgages, you know, interest in food, clothing. You've got to be really pretty renounced person already to go to a very specific environment where you could practice this 12 hours, 14 hours a day for a couple of years, and then you might achieve this. And this is possible. And there are people right now looking like you and me, not just Asian people, you know, doing this technique. It's a living technique. It's been a living technique for several thousand years. People right now are achieving this state of single-pointed concentration, they call it, okay? So this technique is just the beginning of the job. It's like learning to completely subdue the grosser levels of our mind, which mean the sensory consciousness and all the crazy conceptuality. But that's just what happens is they've been able to access this more subtle level of their own mind. Now, we don't posit such a state as existing in modern psychology or in neuroscience, so that's where it sounds mystical to us. But that's the Buddha's view. and the Hindus before, that our consciousness has these subtler levels of cognition, but we're asleep to them. We never go there because we don't have techniques. Do you understand my point? Much subtler levels of cognition. And it sounds abstract to us, but at that subtler level, it is beyond conceptual and it is beyond the sensory. The best I can say is those words, literally. And Lama Yeshe talks about that in this book, exactly. So the only reason you want that... So, okay, the byproduct, the benefits of that alone are pretty stunning. Your mind would be quite astonishing. You would have, you know, but the purpose of that technique is so that you can do the real job, because there's two main modes of meditation in Buddhism. This is the first one. It's like you've honed, it's like you've achieved the microscope of your mind. Now you're going to do the real job of what I've implied already, of digging deep into the mind and unpacking and unraveling at a really sophisticated, subtle level. And we don't have, again, we have no methods like that in our culture, where you can unpack and unravel and rid the mind of all this nonsense that goes real deep down. Not into the past, but into the mind itself. So it sounds abstract to us, but this is the way of saying it. So the concentration, yeah, if you've got that samadhi, as they call it, or single point of concentration, you'd look like you were dead. Do you understand? But you've gone to a subtle level of your own mind, super laser-like focus, and you can work at a much subtler level in your mind to do this job very quickly, the Buddha says we can all do, of ridding the mind of all the rubbish and growing all the goodness. Do you understand? Okay. Some other questions? I mean, it's science fiction to us because we don't talk like this in our culture, you know. We talk about the brain, and we don't talk about the brain having a true true nature, you know, full of, you know, free of all. We cut out the brain. I mean, isn't it back in the 30s we did lobotomies, hoping we cut out the anger bits, you know? We tried that, didn't work. We're not discussing the brain here. You know, we're discussing our cognitive process itself, which is subtler than the brain. The Buddhist view would say. So, are there any questions? More questions? Yeah. Where's the mic? Here we go. Yes.
So, is it on? Okay. Let's say that you notice a thing. Like, you're driving in traffic and you're like, oh, my God, I'm getting really tight.
That's right. That's right.
What's the next, like, practical
thing? Well, in a way, you see, even then, in a way, it's a bit late. That's the wheels falling off. So this is the point that it's really hard to hear it, but that's the point. If we start feeling it physically, this is my point now, we only notice when it's physical and when your heart's shaking and you want to hold it. That's the wheels falling off. So, of course, we've got to start somewhere. You can't notice, you've got to start at the grossest level and notice when the wheels are falling off, and then you've got to go learn from that and realize I better start learning techniques so I can start to notice the problems before it gets severe. And that's why we have to learn in this practical way to become familiar, even to start focusing our mind, because even for 5 minutes every day, if you're doing a focusing meditation, like you focus on your breath or something, you're anchoring your mind to that for 5 minutes. Not because the breath is anything special, not because anything magical happened, but just it's a training. You're training yourself to not follow every crazy thought that comes. The thoughts won't go away. You'll think you're getting crazy, but you don't. We mindlessly follow all the thoughts if they come up strong. We have no control over that. We're learning to control our mind. Not the crazy thoughts, but learning to control our ability to stay focused on something without wandering off having a chat with what goes on inside our head. That's the simplest way to put what concentration is. But my key point is this. We won't get that samadhi like I'm talking about overnight by doing 5 minutes every day. That's ridiculous. But what we will learn, what we're learning, is the skill to step out of our head for 5 minutes. And because in your meditation, maybe you're focusing on your breath, but you can't help but hear the thoughts. So in your daily life, you bring to bear this skill. So now you go to the kitchen, and because you've been sitting for 5 minutes, you're training yourself to stay focused. You're going to be focusing on the dishes, focusing on the hubby, but you can't help but also notice your thoughts. And then you're going to be noticing all the crazy stories before they get to the mouth. That's the point. And then you reconfigure them there. So as you're driving the car, you don't wait till the guy nearly jumps in front of you, but you're watching what's going on in your mind. And this takes time, darling. And you're working with your thoughts and telling yourself, shut up, it's okay, relax, all is cool, don't worry about it. You're kind of talking yourself through it in a very natural kind of way before it gets serious. That's real progress. That's what we have to get to, and that's what we're capable of. But we've got to start somewhere, and it's not that easy. But we've got to know it's possible because it's our mind, and if I can't work with my mind, then, you know, who can? But the other part is this. Because we don't notice until the emotions come, we're terrified of it. We can't stand the pain. If you have one small argument with somebody, you know, the pain, or if somebody's rejected you, look at the pain we feel. And then, of course, we believe this is me. This jealousy, this anger, this, like, it'll never end. It is unbearable. So what happens is we start to get some confidence that this is pain, but it's not permanent. I can work with it. We kind of be kind to ourselves, talk ourselves through it, have a little weep, have a little sleep, and wake up next morning, it'll feel a lot better. But we have to learn to be courageous, to learn to, it's like I always think about learning to live with all your crazy roommates. Really, it's like that. There are crazy thoughts in there, but we can also bring in the good thoughts, but we forget to do that. Because I've never met anybody who has a problem with thinking good thoughts all day. Do you understand? I can't stop my good thoughts. I'm just thinking good thoughts all day. I've never met a person who says that. Do you understand? So we've got to sometimes bring up the good thoughts, which means, you know, like, what's your name?
Rose.
So, you know, like, there's Rose, and we're talking to ourselves. We talk to ourselves all the time, don't we? And, you know, Rose, that jealousy, and I'm so depressed, and she said this and all that. And then you should bring up your little kind thoughts, because I always think of the crazies in running the house. But the poor, you know, the kind thoughts and the generous thoughts and the self-respectful thoughts, they're kind of hiding under the bed or in the closet, you know. They've got to bring them out. And then little Rose, like, come on, Rose, give it a break, darling. It's all right. It's not forever. I know it's hurtful. She did that to me. She said this. She did that. It's okay. It'll pass, sweetheart. And you be kind to yourself. But we're so brutal to ourselves. They're virtuous thoughts. We can conjure them up any damn time we like, but we just don't think to. We just buy into all the dramas, you know. Then we go, oh, I'm so bad, I'm so hopeless, I'm hopeless, I'm no good, this is me. This is just very old habits. It's like almost, this is almost so simple what I'm saying. This is like, as Ramayeshi puts it, it's being your own therapist. Not joking. And then you have more courage when the unhappy thoughts come again. You've got the pain, even your tears. It's okay. You talk yourself through it. It's all right. It'll pass. And when you think of it that way, not grasp onto them. Honestly, when you have a good sleep, you wake up next morning and it'll be less pain, you know. The pain goes more quickly, but become more courageous. And it's our thoughts. They're ours and they're old habits. So the thing is, you've got to be familiar with them too. You've got to know what the habits are so you can change them. Do you understand? It's not easy, Rose. It's not easy. But it's doable. This is the thing. We have to have courage. Are we communicating, people?
Yes.
This is practical, down-to-earth stuff, I promise. Nothing holy. You know? Do you understand? So if it is at the point where you're about to shoot your mouth off in the car, then, you know, even if you do shoot your mouth off, you have an awareness that you did it. Uh-oh, here we go again, Rose. You know, what to do. Do you understand? At least notice you did it. But what we do is we defend our right to do it. Do you understand? The other extreme is we get guilty. That's one of our worst crimes against ourselves. Guilt is disgusting. Guilt is not beneficial. It's useless. It's not practical. It doesn't help. It's awful. It's self-hate, basically. So we have to stop going to guilt as well. Because the key point the Buddha is making, speaking very simply, you know, we do have anger, we do have jealousy, we do have love, we do have kindness. We have many qualities that make up our person. We all know that. We all know that. But as soon as the unhappy ones come, we seem to paint the whole of ourselves with that one brush. You know, I did two bad things, and then we say, oh, I'm a bad person. Well, no, you're not a bad person. Shooting your mouth off is not so cool. Being mean to your boyfriend isn't cool, but the rest of you's fine. I mean, we have to be practical. Do you understand? Really, do you understand? I mean, and that's what anger is. You think about one of the key things in Buddhist psychology, all these neuroses, one of their key functions is they exaggerate. So when I'm really mad at somebody, we all know in that few moments you're really angry with that person, the whole person looks ugly, don't they? And you think the whole person is horrible. But when you calm down, you only know it was 2.5 things they did, and the rest of them is okay. You calm down, you relax. It's the same with ourselves. Guilt thinks all of me is bad. It's too extreme. I remember the Christians have an amazing saying, don't criticize the sinner, criticize the sin. Don't criticize yourself. Criticize the rubbish in you. Be brave enough to own it and see that it's breaking your heart. And that's the key thing in the first stages of practice in Buddhism. We're not discussing compassion yet. That's more advanced. We're trying to see how we harm ourselves, how this stuff is breaking our hearts. That's a crucial step. Not to be guilty about this, but to realize it's hurting us. That's a really powerful point. But we love to hate ourselves, you know. It's awful. It really is awful. We have to stop doing that one. Be more kind to ourselves. Because the Buddha's point is this stuff is why we suffer. This is why we suffer. We suffer because of our anxiety. We suffer because of our anger. We suffer because of our jealousy. But yeah, we harm others too, but we're not looking at that yet. We're trying to see what makes us suffer so we can change. And then we can start to have compassion for others. This is a really important point, I tell you. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So I have been working on being more vulnerable because I value healthy relationships. And I have been coming up on, you speak what you want, you're kind, you're generous, but to show how you love and how you care for people is how you live more fully. So I am valuing what you're saying about how to handle these difficult emotions, but could you speak a little bit more to how to handle the, I think, I know it's a good thing, I need to do this, but how to handle the sense of I feel really out of control when I'm vulnerable, even though when I tolerate it and I get through it.
Okay, so say a bit more what you mean by vulnerable. Say a bit more what you mean by that.
Oh, dear.
Vulnerable.
What I'm doing right now is good. it's more of like just speaking honestly about how I feel.
Okay. Okay, well, I think a really major point, this stuff is all very contextual. I mean, if you you want to be nice to the animals and you have a little pussycat and you pat the little pussycat and then a python comes along and you're going to be vulnerable to the python, I would suggest you don't be vulnerable to the python. I suggest you walk right away, baby. So you've got to have some wisdom. So if there's a person you're all vulnerable with, they're going to smash you. Because when our own delusions are what make us harm others. So there's a nice soft person there. A person with a bit of aggression will brutalize you and misuse that and turn it against you. So have some common sense and show it only to people that you trust, please, as a first big step. And even then, I think we can be very naive about trusting. When we think in relationships, especially partnership, like lover relationships, we've got to somehow show every aspect of our being. I think that's beyond naive. I don't mean to be secret and hide things, but there's almost like a childish one. They've got to show everything. What for? I mean, it's like, I'm not sure. Be appropriate. Everything's interdependent. Everything's appropriate. This person says this much and you say that much and you're kind of playing tennis with each other and then you learn together how to, but sometimes in the beginning we kind of vomit everything out to give the whole, like I'm going to take all my washing and dump it on you, hoping that you can handle it. Sometimes it's a bit much for people. I'm not saying you're saying that, but it's like it's interdependent. As you learn to play tennis with each other, you get better and see each other's skills and you know how to be with each other. It's much more wise and interdependent than just, I'm going to be vulnerable. I mean, are you with me? It's wise. You've got to put wisdom in it. I mean, there's a nice analogy in Buddhism that a bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. So you could say the compassion wing is the point where you're absolutely open to others, give others, love others, take care of others. That's amazing. But as the Dalai Lama says, compassion is not enough. You've got to have wisdom. And that's what we're talking here, this first stuff. This first stuff's all about us, what makes us brokenhearted, what hurts us, how we have low self-esteem and don't have respect for ourselves. Working on our own mind and this rubbish stuff first and growing our own good qualities, that's the wisdom wing. And then from that literally does come some wisdom and some common sense about how to be wisely compassionate to others, not naively open to everybody. You understand what I'm saying? So it's got to be both jobs we do. Be our own therapist, deal with our own stuff, and then to that degree we can realize everybody's in the same boat and we can be appropriate. And we all know that being open to one person looks different if you're open to another person. It can't be the same. But often we're just naive about it. That's, I think, is the problem. Are we communicating, do you think?
Yeah.
But is that answering your question? A little bit. Not necessarily.
Say the conditions are there, that, you know, I pick appropriate friends and so forth and so on. It's that act of stepping out of the comfort zone and then being comfortable with being a kind of out in the wind and knowing I'm going to be okay. That's where I struggle. I mean,
it's lovely words, but you've got to have to be a bit more specific because we can all interpret that differently. Give us a specific example, please. It helps the mind.
So you know how you were talking about the negative situation where, you know, it's come out and it's over. You're done. You've got the wheels have fallen off and you're in trouble. It's the flip side of taking a good risk. Taking a good risk.
No, tell me what that means, please. Give us be specific.
Okay.
You've got to be specific.
You express an emotion that is going to be received well with a safe person.
No, wait a minute. Is this emotion negative or positive?
Positive. A kindness.
So you reach out to somebody and say, I'll pay for your taxi. No? I mean, can you be on the earth, girl? It helps. You've got to be on the earth, otherwise we can all interpret your words. They're very beautiful, but they're not very concrete. And I'm not trying to be boring.
No,
you've
got
to give me a practical
experience,
an example. I mean, I know your words are meaning, but you've got to be more practical as an example. Try and give an example, darling.
Oh.
Most recent, when you made yourself vulnerable to somebody. Come on. And you showed a kindness.
Reaching out to somebody who looks like they needed it.
Okay.
And then...
But are they a friend or a stranger?
An acquaintance. And they are...
Okay, wait a minute. It's an acquaintance means not very close relationship.
It's someone you see every day.
Person at work.
Let's say, yeah.
Let's say. And yeah. You know, you're not that close to this person.
But it's like bringing someone in that may be on the outside, and then bringing them in and saying, come, friend.
Okay, so you mean there's a group of people, and you're all friendly, chatty, and you see a person who looks a bit on the outside.
Yes.
And you reach out to that person, and you constantly bring them in.
Not constantly, but just bring
consciously.
Them in. Consciously.
Consciously,
yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, where's the problem?
It's taken that risk that it won't go well. Or
so the risk would be what? They say, mind your own business.
Or that you'll be perceived as, like, a nut.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay, that's fine. Then you have to prepare to risk it.
Okay.
That's easy. Prepare to risk it. And you learn from your experiences, darling.
Okay.
That's it.
That'll
very
work.
Simple. And that's what wisdom is.
Okay.
Because what, you see, compassion is empathy with others. But that, and you've got to have that always. That's the big picture. Always to have the wish to be connected to others and to help others. But it's not compassion that makes you do the right thing. That's wisdom. And that's all I'm talking here. So the more you grow yourself, the more you know yourself, the more you less neurotic, less fearful, less depressed, more wise, more content, the more wisdom you will have, and you'll know the degree to which you can reach out to another. And you wouldn't even be feeling vulnerable because you'd be having some certainty, and that comes from the wisdom wing. You'd have certainty. So let's say you have an alcoholic brother. You adore him, you love him, and this is the point in Buddhism. There's a very distinction between the neurotic states of mind and the kind of the wholesome ones. So love is connected, is wanting him to be happy. Compassion is empathy with his suffering. They're pure and marvelous, but they often get dragged down by our own neurotic neediness, our attachment, and our own fears and our own junk. You understand? So there you are as a normal person, having not looked at your mind much, and you see your brother, you see his suffering, and you have compassion, you do have, and you want to help him. But what we don't realize is that our neediness to have everything lovely, which is what attachment wants, and that's upsetting the apple cart. Him being an alcoholic is upsetting my life. So that's upsetting my attachment. So I'll stick my nose in where it doesn't belong, thinking I'm being so kind, and he says, back off and mind your own business. That's because I lack the wisdom, because I was pushed by my own neediness to make him all lovely and happy. So sometimes we can't make everybody happy. Sometimes we can't fix it all. And often that comes from our neurotic neediness to make everything lovely. And that's just attachment. You with me? So you might love your brother, but no, there's no way he's open to any advice. So you don't even give him advice. How are you, darling? You love him for who he is. You don't criticize him. You leave him there. But you watch, and then one day you might see a window of opportunity when you know he's ready for advice. That's when there's less attachment in us to make everything lovely. Because attachment can easily be seen as kindness, but often it's our own neediness to make everything lovely. Because attachment can't stand unhappy things. It's very subtle in us. Are you with me?
I am.
You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay. What else, people? Behind you, onto your left, over there. Over there. Over there. Yeah.
Well... First of all, I feel so happy to be able to hear you.
Good, darling.
And about the guilt you were talking about, I was about to cry because I feel very guilt. Like, I really love all the teachings and they really make sense to me and all the philosophy, but I feel very guilty every time that I can't follow them.
I see.
You know, every time that I just kill a mosquito. Or that I just, yeah. Or
you mean consciously kill a mosquito?
Yeah.
Consciously?
Yes.
Okay, what's an alternative to, so why would you feel guilty about killing a mosquito?
Because
what does guilt sound like? Tell me the words that guilt would say.
It's a living being.
What's the words guilt would say? You said you feel guilty, so tell me what guilt would say if it, speak guilt out.
That's wrong. He deserves.
So you say that. So you kill it constantly and then you say it's wrong.
Yes.
Well, you better make a decision. To either keep killing it and not say it's wrong, or not kill it and so you have to say it's wrong. You've got a decision to make.
I know. But that happens not only.
Excuse me, no, I'm serious. You have a decision to make. You can't say, oh, I shouldn't kill a mosquito, but constantly decide to kill a mosquito. So you've got to make choice. Continue to kill mosquitoes and stop being guilty, or stop killing mosquitoes and then relax. So you've got to make a decision. You've got to be a guilt is not grown up. Guilt is like a baby that wants to stay in misery. You've got a decision to make. You've got to be accountable. You've got to decide on one or the other. So what would you like to do?
Well, of course, not to kill it. But
and why is it so hard for you not to kill a mosquito? You just shoo it away.
Yeah.
Why do you have to kill it?
But it's not only that. It's a lot of things. Like every
excuse
time
me,
that I
excuse
get
excuse me,
angry.
Excuse me. You just want to keep being guilty. I give you solutions. You say, oh, not just that. Let's solve the mosquito problem first. One step at a time. It's your call. You have to be grown up enough to decide. Either you continue consciously to kill mosquitoes and accept that's your decision and you live with the consequences, or you decide, I will stop killing mosquitoes and do my best. You have to, that's, guilt is useless. Guilt is standing on the fence and never makes a decision and just stays stuck. It's not accountability. It's not grown up. So you've got to think about that seriously, darling. You've got to make a decision and live with whichever that decision is. It's up to you. Are we communicating?
Yes.
So there's no point in using other examples. So I'll answer the same way. Well, give me one more example. I'll see what happens. What's another example?
When I get really, really mad with my husband.
What?
When I get really, really mad with my husband.
What do you do when you get mad at him? Shout and yell, abuse him, punch him? What do you do?
No, I tell him awful things. Things that I don't believe.
Come on, now we have confession time. What do you say to him? I mean, you kill a mosquito.
I don't know.
What do you do to your husband?
Like, every time that I get mad, every
what?
Time that I get mad with something, with my mom, my husband, they always say to me that
I don't care about them. I'm talking about you here. I don't care about them. I'm talking about you here. What do you say to your husband? How often do you
something that is going to hurt him? Whatever.
You say that,
something
you
that
you
I know
really
is going to hurt him.
You shout really loud.
Yes.
And how long do you shout for?
How long?
This is a serious discussion. 3 minutes? 1 minute?
All day.
No, please be realistic, darling.
No, like,
please be,
yeah, I cry.
Excuse me, don't exaggerate. Tell me how many times a day you would shout at your husband.
3 times a day.
Three. You just said all day, so please make up your mind. 3 times.
No.
Three times.
Yes.
How long will each occasion last? I'm serious. See, your problem is you just sit there and swim in this guilt emotion like a little girl, like the rest of us. You don't do this analysis. That's why I'm purposely driving you to look into this in reality, because already you are exaggerating your badness. All day, you happily said. So excuse me, 3 times, how come you don't always sing each other? Isn't he often doing a job? Are you doing a job?
No, but if I'm with...
Could you answer my questions, please? I'm running the show here. How many times do you have a job?
No.
Does he have a job?
Yes.
So he's off all day?
Yes.
So it's only in the mornings and the evenings you shout at him?
And I can text him and send him voice messages. I do that. All day.
Okay. So again, you have some decisions to make. So what do you think? This is how you deal with guilt, darling. Guilt is completely like a child who doesn't want to change but thinks it's virtuous to think you're a bad person. It's not virtuous. It's embarrassing. And we're all the same, sweetheart. So you're just the guinea pig here. So what do you think you're going to try and do? What do you think your solution? What do you think the solution is, darling, practically? Do you think the solution is?
I try to meditate to stop all that.
Excuse me, I don't mention meditation. What do you think the solution is?
Stop doing that.
What do you think the solution is?
Not get
angry. If you're playing the piano and you notice you play the wrong note, what is the solution?
Practice more.
Thank you. You play the right note. So what's the solution here? You're saying that you get angry easily. Yes? Is that true, darling?
Yes.
A few times a day you get angry.
Yes.
That's right. And so what do you think you should do about that for your sake? Forget your husband. What do you think you should do about it for your sake? What do you think you should do about it? You're the rest of us. You're just like the rest of us. What do you think you should do about it, sweetheart? What do you think you should do about it? What's your solution? What's your decision to make? What
Not
do you think,
to
darling?
Get angry. Only
but how do you think you're going to do that? Do you practice at the end of the day where you do purification practice? Have you heard of that?
Yes.
You know about the regretting and all those things. You do that practice?
No.
Well, then no wonder you don't change. You're not doing the practice that's appropriate. At the end of the day, it's really simple psychology. You sit down on your own little cushion, your own little seat, like a grown-up, not like feeling like a little girl, and you regret the things you've done today. You regret the bad-mouthing, the three texts, the five this, the four that. And you sincerely regret it. But regret is, what's your name?
Aleida.
Elena. Elena.
With a D, Aleida.
Aleida. So you say to yourself, Aleida, I am sick of this anger. Are you sick of it, Aleida?
Yes.
You talk to yourself, darling. I am sick of this anger. I am fed up with this nonsense. I regret from the depths of my heart the bad mouthing to my husband, to my mother, to this and to that, and the mosquitoes I've been killing. I really regret this because I don't want these habits because I am sick of the suffering. So until we start doing that, not guilt. Guilt is I'm a bad person, but it's useless. This other attitude is more wholesome and is more grown up and is more accountable. We own our, we're human. We're humble with ourselves. I have got these bad habits. I can't stand the pain of these bad habits. I'm sick of these. Look at the suffering it's causing me. This first step, regret, is compassion for ourselves. You have to see what it's doing to you. This is a powerful step, Aleida, that most of us don't do. You truly mean that. Can you hear this? Can you hear this?
Yes.
The next step, you think, and if you have a Buddhist practice, whom can I turn to? So you have refuge. You've got a Buddhist practice?
Yes.
Okay, good. The second part is now you can afford to have compassion for the mosquito.
About the Buddhist practice is that was my point. Like sometimes I stop coming because I feel like
You're going right back to the same point. You're not listening to anything I'm saying. You just want to keep telling me how you feel so guilty. You just want to keep, you just love telling every, you just love saying how bad you are because you keep going back to the problems. You don't have any will to change. It doesn't sound like you really want to change then or later. I have to conclude that. You don't want me finished telling you the advice. You said you don't do it. So I'm trying to give you a piece of advice, sweetheart. Are you hearing me, Aleida?
Yes.
Do you want me to finish the practice for you?
Yes, please.
Have you heard of this practice before? Aleida, if you haven't, just say no. Don't mislead me.
I think yes.
You don't know. You've never heard of the four opponent powers.
No.
So you haven't heard of it before?
No.
Okay. So you need to learn this practice, darling. The first step is simple. You sit down and you think of the things you've done today that have hurt others, which hurt you. And you regret them for your sake. It's genuine kindness to yourself. Can you hear that? Because
yes.
You're sick of it, aren't you? You're sick of this pain. You don't want this pain, do you?
No.
You're sick of it, aren't you? Right. So you say that to yourself sincerely. Then you think. Then the next step is you now have compassion for those you've harmed. The first is compassion for yourself. The second one is compassion for the mosquito, compassion for your husband, compassion for your mother, because you know what it's like for people to harm you, darling, don't you? And you have compassion for them. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Is your husband mean to you?
No.
Okay. So the third step is you do a little practice. Do you do any mantras or anything like that? You have no practices like that?
No.
Okay, so you just visualize white light pouring into you, completely purifying all this horrible stuff that you're so sick of. You with me? Imagine it so strongly, purifying every atom of your anger, every atom of your nonsense. And the fourth step, you make some decisions, and you say to yourself, I promise I will not badmouth my husband, at least for one day. You say that promise to yourself as strong as possible. And you go to bed with a happy mind. And you remember your decision the next day. And because you've made the decision, then you will begin to keep that word to yourself. It's so practical, this stuff. This is what being your own therapist means. Instead of running around in your head with guilt and nonsense, there's no virtue in that. There's no, because you've never put it down to being practical. Are you hearing me, Aleida?
Yes.
Does it make any sense?
Yes.
Do you think you're grown up enough to do this?
Yes.
Yes, you are. Give it a try. And do it tonight when you go home to bed, before you go to bed, with your husband, no doubt. You hop in the same bed as your husband, do you?
Yes.
Okay. Do your practice first. And then you'd be nice to him when you get into bed. And you go to bed with a happy mind. In the morning, you remember your vow. You remember it and you want to keep it for your own sake. You'd be so happy. You'd be so happy to keep your vow to yourself, wouldn't you? And you give it for 24 hours. And you report back tomorrow.
Yes.
Or come and see me secretly and tell me if you succeeded.
Yes.
Are we communicating, Aleida?
Yes.
This is called practice. It calls putting your money where your mouth is and being accountable and grown up and knowing we can change, darling. I'm sure everybody understands what I'm saying. Everybody understands. So thank you for being the example. But be serious. Be serious, Aleida. Try it tonight. You regret the things you've done because you're sick of the suffering. Then you have compassion for those. Then you imagine this white light completely purifying you. Then you make a decision for 24 hours and you truly mean it and you're vowing it to yourself. And then tomorrow morning you remember it. Don't tell your husband. Do not tell anybody. It's your personal practice. I promise you, you'll see success. I promise you. This is a practice we do every day, that Lama Zopa says we're insane not to do every day. This helps us put our lives together. It's simple. And we keep it's manageable, one day at a time, you know. Do you understand, darling? Any other questions? Other questions? Oops, it's easy.
Okay.
Yep.
So you said that our...
Where are you? Oh, sweet, I see you.
Hello.
Yes, go, darling.
You said that the three poisons or the three toxic...
A bit louder, darling.
The three poisons or the three toxic emotions,
yes,
are not intrinsic to us.
Are not at the core of our being and can be removed.
They
That's Buddha's deal.
Okay, so they're not our true nature.
What?
They're not our true nature.
No, that's what Buddha would say.
So
he says the virtue and goodness and clarity and wisdom and kindness and joy are our true nature.
They're
our true nature, baby.
Yep, that's my question.
That's the answer. That's Buddha's finding. I mean, it's a bit, even just to hear it, it's a bit uplifting, isn't it?
Yes.
Don't just believe it. Look into it. And there's logic to it, but we've got to go into it more deeply. It's very empowering. And that's why guilt is so overwhelming, because we really believe, like a lady, this is who she really is, and it's hopeless, and I can't change, and it's a disaster, blah, 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 you know. Yeah, this is Buddha's point. And there's logic to it, but it takes a while to look into it. It's very specific. The Buddhist view is very specific. Do you understand?
Yes.
Yeah. What else, people? Yep. Yes.
So if you have someone who has caused you, say, emotional harm.
Yes. And everybody's got somebody like that, worse or less, you know, in our lives.
So you try to practice,
yes,
compassion for that person. But in the end, it's almost like you're allowing them to do it over and over
again. Okay, no, there's much more to it than that. Much more to it than that. So is the assumption in this relationship that the two people are together? Or that they're separate?
Oh, yes, yes. say, for instance, family members.
Yes, exactly, exactly, darling. This is the part, I mean, in one sense, it's sort of too brutal to answer this way, but at least we start with it. Is, again, the Buddha's point, if we can change something, how amazing. And then the next step is, if we can't, what do we do if we can't change it? Meaning, if we can't get the other person to be different, in other words. That's what we mean by change, isn't it? So then we, in a sense, you know, this is what's so hard to hear, it's kind of brutal to hear it. In a sense, we have two options. If we can't handle it, we leave. And this is terrifying for most people. I think most of us in this room, whether it's your husband, whether it's your daughter, whether it's your mother, whether it's your boss, whether it's your colleague, our first response is, oh no, I couldn't do that. I couldn't leave, I won't get another job. I couldn't leave, it's my mother. I couldn't leave, it's my husband. I couldn't leave, he really loves me. I couldn't leave, it's my daughter. We instantly say, no, it's not possible. And I think we've got to have the courage to look at that. Do you understand what I'm saying, darling? So the other option is to choose to stay and then work with it. And if we can do that, wow, that's the best practice in the universe. But then the point about that is, you can look at two dogs. One is more powerful and one is the victim. But look, if the victim suddenly becomes strong, look what the powerful dog does. He cringes down like a victim. So if when we become powerful, the other person has no power over us. And that is so powerful to understand. Easy to say it, but if we start to have confidence in that, if a person's, in other words, this is so brutal to say it, because we can see on this planet people abuse other people beyond bearing. People imprison people for 50 years abusing them. We know how shocking it is. But all I can do is talk about these possibilities. If it is us who's being abused, having compassion, no, is not enough. Having compassion is not enough. There's got to be the wisdom. And when we have wisdom, the Buddhist view is less, that means when you've got wisdom, it's less anger, less fear, less jealousy, less attachment, less worry, less anxiety, more power, more self-confidence, more courage. So when you're like that, no one can harm you. The person will become pathetic. The person will become pathetic. But we have to know where we're at. Are you with me? And I think that's where we can easily fall into the trap of thinking sometimes this is blaming the victim. No, we as victims need to become powerful. The world is full of people who abuse. There's racism and sexism and brutality and terrorism everywhere you turn, in relationships, in businesses, everywhere you turn. People are being abused by others. There's no question. So if we are the abused, we have to if we have enough courage, if we have the courage, we can become strong. And therefore, the whole dynamic of that relationship would change. But that's a pretty big ask. And if we're not capable and if it's too difficult, we get the hell out of there. But that's even, for some people, is even a worse decision, more terrifying. Do you understand what I'm saying? We've got to know where we're at. We've got to know where we're at. Compassion without wisdom is like just nothing. It's pathetic. It's no use. Are we communicating at all?
Yes.
Yes. So we've got to have the courage to know we either can deal with it, which means it won't be allowing them anymore. They wouldn't be. It won't allow them anymore. It won't, because they'll be changing. It's a dynamic, you know. In other words, if you're playing with Federer, you're playing tennis with Federer, and that's the whole point. Federer's the powerful one. Federer's beating you all over the court. You feel like completely victimized. Instead of, you know, the victim often in us keeps complaining about how good Federer is, but we've got to become as strong as Federer, and then he'll become the victim. I don't mean that in a bad way. We've got to remember that. We have the power. But if that situation is so terrible, the abuse is so shocking, we have to have the... Because we've only got two choices. Like I said to Aleda, she's got two choices. Kill mosquitoes and be content with it, or stop killing mosquitoes. But it's too terrifying to hear that it seems so simple. So we either stay if we can be brave enough to change, and that means disempower the person. They become a wimp. Because you can't be hurt if you're strong. And that really is true when it comes to abuse. It's really true, you know. Or leave. And that's often, for most of us, even harder. Do you understand? So, but are we communicating, darling?
Yes.
Good. We have to have courage, you know. We have to have real courage. Yes. And it could take years to get to either one of these decisions. That's the problem. Because we can't work faster than we can work, you know. We can't go faster than we can go. Meanwhile, if we're in the victim one, get as many support, much as support as possible. So we can become strong. You understand? Got to have friends. Got to have friends, you know. Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here and coming. That inner aspect of ourselves that is so condemning.
The telling ourselves off.
As shame.
Yes.
So is that?
Precious girl, we've got to start saying good things about ourselves. It sounds so corny and so pathetic, and especially if we've been brutalized and criticized by so many people in our lives, we just buy into that, you know? We've really got to learn to somehow know this, just to somehow start to even say a few good things about ourselves. Even a few good things about ourselves. It sounds so easy, but it is so hard for us. Or at least have good supportive friends who we know love us. Darling, we have to get reinforcement somewhere. Eventually we have to do it ourselves. But if we can get it from the outside first, that helps. That's a good start. But we have to believe it. Because often when we have such low self-esteem and we think we're so horrible, 27 people can tell us we're wonderful. 27 people can tell us they love us, but somehow we won't believe it. That's the tragedy. You understand?
So is shame like the first cousin of guilt?
Yes, shame and guilt, I think, in the way... So would you say that shame is beating yourself up for bad things you've done? Is that shame?
No.
What's shame then, darling? Tell me.
Shame is a sense of awfulness. That you've taken in some kind of... I think it starts out for me with disapproval, with... You know, little.
disapproval and not measuring up to what is
other people expect.
Yes.
Sweetheart, this is very, 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 very fascinating. This, I'd say, is the deepest, the deepest pain we have, the deepest attachment, more than for sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the deepest attachment we have is for other people to approve of us.
Yes.
In other words, since we're tiny, there's been this assumption deep in our bones that unless someone says I'm a nice person, we assume we aren't.
Yes.
And that's such a terrible thing. It is so terrible. So all our lives, we're hungry for people to approve of us. But the trouble is when we get the disapproval, the irony is we believe the disapproval more than the approval. And we've gotten to the habit of that. And it's so heartbreaking. Because, you know, let me just ask you a few questions. Off the cuff. Do you kill? Do you kill? Do you lie?
No.
Do you steal?
No.
Do you abuse people?
No.
Well, already you're like 1% of this planet. You should be, you know, you should be weeping in happiness that you're a virtuous, ethical, kind person. But we hear those words, but we, you know, you should, I mean, think about it, darling. Think about that. You're a kind person with good ethics. This is phenomenal on this planet. But this shows how long we've been thinking these bad things and believing those views from other people. Sweetheart, we've got to start somewhere counting your good qualities. I mean, there's almost no other way to do it. It's easy to say these words, but we've got to start somewhere, sweetheart. Because it's an old habit, this deep habit you have of just you're not worthy, you're not enough. That's what you're saying, isn't it? You're not enough, you're not good enough, you're not worthy. Is it because in your life you've had people telling you that all the time? Is that what's happening in your life now? No? That's how you feel in yourself?
Yes.
The second one, it's how you feel in yourself?
Yes. It's like this is the old stuff that comes up.
That's
the
right.
The deeper we go,
exactly.
That I go into.
I understand, darling.
Yes.
So do you think it's possible for you personally to change this habit? What do you think just personally? What do you feel? Based on what I'm saying.
Yes, I see
you
it.
You think it's
changing.
Possible?
I see it changing.
Well, darling, you've got to start somewhere.
Lesson.
Just start somewhere, tiny, inch by inch by inch. Really be humble with yourself. Really be patient with yourself. Hang around people who are kind. Nourish yourself with these thoughts and feelings and words. We've got to do it, sweetheart. We've got to do it.
And is also the remedy part of the purification, the four-step purification?
Absolutely. This is very much purified.
It's tied into that.
Yes, you can easily ease it. I mean, usually the purification process is all you're regretting all the rubbish, and then you have compassion for those who, and then you do the purification. But also you can kind of also add to that to be finishing with rejoicing in all the good qualities, rejoicing in your ethics, rejoicing in your goodness, rejoicing in your kindness, rejoicing really genuinely. And this is one of the practices we all of us never do, because the negative voices come very strongly, and because they come automatically, we think they're more powerful than they really are. We've got to bring those good voices, like I said, out of the closet and from under the beds. We've got to think positive things. It sounds almost too corny, but we've got to do that. And the Buddha's view is every thought counts. Every thought counts, you know. So every positive thought you have is nourishing your heart. Start slowly. But we've got to be sincere about it and know it works.
Because
it's your mind, baby. Do you understand?
Yes.
Good, darling.
Yes,
what's your name?
Carol.
Carol, thank you, sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
What else, people? Questions? More questions?
Hi, yes?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd like, I'm a little bit confused about the first poison. You had said something about it being an effect of the self, or perhaps the self itself.
Self-grasping, that one, yeah.
Yeah, could you go on a little bit more about that
one?
It's
quite subtle, this one. Yeah, exactly. This is the root problem. This is the one such that when this is removed from our mind, after having got single-pointed concentration and working for many years in doing this unpacking and unraveling, that's when you finally cut ego altogether. That's the deepest, most subtle, most primordial. So, this is what Lama Yeshe talks about in this book, you know. The Buddha's saying that deep in our bones is this assumption that there's somehow some of this concrete, unchanging, set in stone kind of an ironically miserable me in there. That's it, really. It's the simplest way to put it. It's kind of ironic that it's miserable. It's not happy. And it's neurotic and it's fear-based. So almost you could argue that when, like Mr. Darwin, I think the scientist, when Mr. Darwin came up with this concept of instinct for survival, I think, isn't it? That when you're attacked or offended, attacked especially the animals and humans, this rises like a sleeping lion, and they say that we need that to make these decisions to run or do whatever. Do you understand? I would say Buddha would like that phrase, because this ego grasping, which is this colloquial phrase for this deep instinctive assumption of a separate, bereft, concrete me, which is so abstract for us, it's most of the time a sleeping lion. And it's only when you're offended or insulted or hurt that it rises up. And that's a really powerful way when we need to see it. But the Buddha says that one is the final one that we have to conquer, the final one that has to go. And that only can be done in subtle meditation, when we've gone to a subtle level of our mind. It's a very advanced level. But we can understand it at first intellectually. I'm sure over the week we'll talk about it more.
So yeah. Would that be a complete renunciation of the self, or...?
More than that, way more than that. The first stages of practice are really giving up. The very first stage of practice, and this is a lady's job. It's exactly a lady. She's a perfect example, darling. Thank you. The first level of practice, Buddha says, given that we're driven by our crazy delusions, you know, a lady talks about her anger, you know, Carol, isn't it? Talks about her, you know, her self, whatever it is. That's the mind. But look, you mightn't run around shouting and jumping on too many people and killing too many mozzies and shouting at too many husbands, do you, Carol?
No.
That's right. Whereas a lady, it's like me. She's got a good mouth. So she's got lots of good qualities too, but you probably forget to see them later. So you've got to do the same as Carol. Look at your good qualities. Look at your kindness, at your open heart, at your intelligence, at your clarity. You've got all of those qualities, darling. But the downside for you, like Lama Yeshe one time said to me, nothing wrong with your heart, dear. It's just your behavior. So Elena's the same. So our job is to go junior school practice. We're talking high school here. Working on your mind is high school. Junior school practice, Elena, is zip the lip and keep our hands to ourselves. So you leave the mozzies alone and you leave the hubby alone. That's your main practice, is control the mouth and control our body. And that's powerful. But then don't have guilt about it. Realize you've got this powerful energy that you can harness and use to do good, Elena. You can use your mouth to do good. You see what I'm saying, darling? Don't kind of beat yourself up for it. But recognize we misuse this part of our energy to harm. And now we can use, so you've got to control it. And that's why the first level of practice is control your body and control your speech. And a miracle will happen if you can do this much. Forget your mind. You're lying there in bed going crazy. At least let it not come out the mouth. That's the first level of practice. Cow's got to go deep into her mind, you know, because she hasn't got a behavior problem. This is a powerful level. So very low, first level, entry level, junior school, grade one, control the body, control the speech. It sounds boring, but it's profound. Because the harm we do, isn't it, Aleda, is with the speech. So that's the first one. Now you go to high school and you can do the renunciation. And this is like the first scope of the Lam Rim. So now you work on your mind. That's the renunciation one. So if you've gotten to that and you've got some renunciation, you'd be a very radiant, blissful person. You would have subdued your body, subdued your speech, subdued your mind. You'd be steady. You'd have equanimity. You'd be calm. You'd be content. You'd be fulfilled. You'd be less neurotic, less depressed, less up and down like a yo-yo. You'd be an amazing person. And that's just renunciation. Now you go to the compassion wing, where you add compassion to the mix, and then you get the emptiness one finally, where you go deep into the mind and get rid of the root delusion. And when you realize emptiness.
And if I may ask, what would that be?
What, darling?
What would that be? The root delusion? Is that
ego grasping?
Right.
That's ego grasping is the root delusion. Right. And that's the realization of emptiness, quote unquote, is when you've cut that one.
Gotcha.
You
with Thank
me?
You.
You with me?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
We'll talk more about that, I'm sure. What else, people? Yes.
Hi. I just want to say I've enjoyed your teaching since good. I was probably 8 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So.
Good. I'm happy.
Yeah, so I've been looking forward to seeing you again.
Good, darling.
The last time.
Wonderful.
But I've started having a lot of difficulty with chronic pain.
A lot of what, darling?
With chronic pain. Like, I have pain every day.
Oh, my God.
And it's gotten to the point where I can be thankful for it in a way that it's my teacher. But
so brave.
I feel like I'm not learning as much from it as I could be. I don't know what practices that I can do to kind of go deeper.
But darling, let's just talk about the pain. You can't stop the pain? That's your first one. If you can change it, change it. You can't?
Yeah, I take...
You've done everything you can?
I take different pain medication, but it makes me, I guess, stupid.
Zonked out.
Yeah, and I can't work with my mind as much as I'd like to, so I made the decision to try and go off a lot of my pain medication.
Wow.
And
amazing.
See, no, like, so if my shoulder's hurting, it's mostly with my joints.
Yes.
So if my shoulder's hurting, whereas if I was taking my muscle relaxers and I was taking all my nerve pain medication, I might not know that it's hurting, but then I wake up the next day and it's hurting a lot more.
Oh, I see.
I don't take my medication, then my mind's clear and it's hurting, and sometimes I can fix it and it's like I can pop it into place.
Wow.
But I feel like I could be benefiting more and learning how to cope with my mind a lot more, because there are definitely times when I get really angry and I'm like, why is this happening to me?
I know, of course you would. That's right. Exactly, darling. I mean, this is a huge one. Whether you're being abused by somebody else, or whether you've got chronic pain, or whether you're, you know, we've all got something, isn't it? We can see it. Even everyone in this room, we've got something. You know, if it's not an external thing, it's internal. It's your own crazy mind. If it's not that, it's your body. If it's not that, it's your husband, you know? I mean, isn't it? There's something, always something. Or if you know, one of my friends in prison where they can't get out and they're treated as animals, you know. There's always going to be something. So, darling, I mean, even the question is so brave. It's so amazing that you want to really work on your mind. It's so incredible. But it seems to me you're doing everything you possibly can. You hear the teachings, do you? You listen to the teachings. You try to apply them. The one of transforming problems. I mean, when I think about, like, the High Lama, when Lama Zopa had his stroke, and I see how he was and how he responded, it's almost too high, you know. I can't believe it, where people can really have pain and really live with it. And it's a very profound practice, sweetheart. And it just means giving up attachment, because this is the part about understanding attachment and aversion. And it, again, sounds so cruel. And this is not being mean to any of us. What's your name, sweetheart?
Miranda.
No, you're Miranda. And what's your name? Yeah.
Autumn.
So Autumn's, I don't know what her scenario is and whether she's even talking about herself, but let's just pretend she's talking about somebody who's got a mean husband. And you are who?
Miranda.
Miranda's talking about, you know, her body. No, I forgot my point here. What was it?
Everybody,
I meant to say something. Sorry.
Everybody's got something.
Everyone's got something, yeah. That in the end, if we understand attachment and aversion, which sounds so cute, these words sound so cute, if we understand the depth of these delusions in the way that Buddhism describes them, we will understand that the reason we suffer in the face of somebody abusing us, or the reason we suffer if our body is suffering, is because of attachment. So in other words, if we can't even conceptualize this, if we didn't have any attachment, that means we would be blissful and joyful people, and whatever arises, we would be able to handle it. That's very weird for us to talk like that in our culture. I mean, it's not criticizing us, but that's... So the more we have attachment for things to be a certain way, the more we get distressed when they don't happen. So whether it's your husband abusing you or whether it's the body harming you, do you understand what I'm saying? It's the same logic. So this is where this stuff's so profound. It sounds so simple, but it is huge. And that's where, like, you know... Autumn's point about having compassion, often that's the typical scenario. I'm going back and forth. I'm not Miranda, I haven't forgotten your point, but it's the same thing. You know, when you're having compassion for somebody, it can be such wrong compassion. It is allowing. It's like learning, when being a doormat is not having compassion for somebody. So being, and that's not Miranda's point, Miranda's point is different. But in the same way, we have to have the strength to go beyond the attachment that wants things to be different. We have to learn to find the way to make them what we want them to be. And that's your case, because you can't escape from your body. Maybe if it's Miranda's partner, she can escape from him. But you can't escape from your body, isn't it? So you've got another whole approach. You know, you've got another whole approach, which is to learn to live with this. I mean... Yeah, it's incredible. But I think you're doing it already, darling. I mean, one step at a time, sweetheart.
Thank you.
You read some of those teachings, you think about those things, you try to meditate on them,
mm-hmm.
or not?
I'm not phenomenal at meditating, and I'm working on it.
But even thinking about it is meditating, darling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you relate it to compassion or not? Can you think of other people suffering? Because that's the one that's really hard. When you're suffering, and to think about how other, and you know, even the practice they have of Tonglen, do you do those kinds of practices?
Yes.
You do that kind of practice. I mean, that's mind-boggling. To think of taking on other people's suffering, that's incredible, darling. You're doing everything you possibly can.
Thank you.
I just wish you'd find some medicine to make your body better.
I think something I am still struggling with is attachment to how I used to be. Like, I was a competitive rock climber, and
right.
Now I'm in a wheelchair, so it's kind of...
Well, now you're in a wheelchair, so you can't... This is something that's progressive, is it?
We don't really know. I haven't gotten answers yet.
That's fascinating. This is very... That will be very painful, darling. That will be very, very painful. That would be very hard to bear. I couldn't bear that. You're being very brave, sweetheart.
Thank you.
I know, don't keep comparing, because this is what happens. This is where, you know, well, I know, this is where, do you have a view of karma or not?
Yes.
You have that view. Mm-hmm. It's meaningful to you.
Yeah, that's what makes it more difficult, I guess.
More difficult. But it should make it less difficult.
Because I'm purifying?
Yeah. If that view is meaningful for you.
It's still, I mean, I guess karma has to work with the idea of reincarnation because...
Yeah, that's right.
I always feel like I've done something to deserve this with
no,
the idea
you
of karma.
No, that's where you must not go. Oh, sweetheart, no, you must not go there. You must not, twisting it around. It's not like that. I mean, the fact is we have... What day am I talking about karma? Going to go into it there. You coming on Wednesday?
Tomorrow.
No, tomorrow. Okay, I'll go into it tomorrow. We'll do it more tomorrow. We'll do more tomorrow, karma. We'll get a perspective on karma.
Okay.
And it can't be just like that. It can't just be that way. See, that's even the way I'm talking for Carol. If you talk about the view of karma. Nevertheless, in spite of this pain and suffering, do you have good things in your life?
Yes.
Kind people?
Mm-hmm.
You got good intelligence? You got a good mind? You're ethical? You don't rape and kill and lie and steal and shout at your husband and kill mosquitoes?
Yeah.
So then you've got something to rejoice in too. And every single tiny second of those is the fruit of your virtue. But we only tend to think of karma when it comes to the bad things. And that's a massive, massive, massive mistake. We'll talk about it tomorrow, sweetheart. I think you're doing amazingly.
Thank you so much.
I think you're doing well, Aleda. I think you're doing well, Autumn. All of us, we've got to and Carol, we've got to rejoice in our good side. We've got to rejoice. We've got to be, and that's what gives us courage and strength, I promise you. Too much. I think it's time to go. 10 to 9. I do talk fast. So, yeah, okay. So, people, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be back in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I'll just sing a little prayer, two little prayers. One of them is just saying, it's you know, dedication. Really, Buddha's saying every thought counts. Nothing goes astray. So here we've been nearly 2 hours. As many thoughts as we've had is as many seeds we've planted. So we'd be delighted in that, you know. So we think maybe nourish these seeds from this moment forward with our effort to practice, however, whatever our practice is, you know, so that we can develop our amazing potential for our sake. And the sake of others. Thinking this way. Kewadi nyududag Lama sangge Drugyune Drowa chikyang Malupa Dei sala Kupasho Jangchob semcho grinpoche Makhe panam kegyuchig Kepanyampa mepayang Gongne gongdu pavasho. Thank you.